Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Samar Batraoui, a doctoral candidate at the Department of War Studies at King's College London.
We talked about the tensions, or lack thereof, between Palestinian nationalism and global jihadi ideology, background and history on Palestinian jihadism, Palestinians and the Islamic State, and what this all means for local Palestinian politics.
Batraoui grew up in Ramallah, and she has a forthcoming article in the CTC Sentinel about Palestinian jihadis and the Islamic State. After the interview, we'll have a new hashtag social media segment, but first we have some primary source releases we're going to cover. And these releases cover the period between July 28th through August the 13th. And Aaron, to start us off, why don't you cover the IS Dawah literature releases that we've seen during that time period?
Over the 2 weeks or so, the Islamic State once again was putting out some of the Dawah literature that it passes out on the streets in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere. And there was one on July 28th called Explaining the Prohibition on Building Upon the Gravestones. And it was highlighting how certain people have been led by Satan to manufacture claims related to tombs and the use of them to lead others astray, and that in some people do this in part for financial gains, but that people need to be aware about this and that, you know, it was illegal within Islam, and that people need to not be deceived by beautifully decorated tombs, and that they're particularly insidious because they're so appealing and will seduce ignorant people. A couple of days later, on August 2nd, they put out a pamphlet related to supporting the Islamic State. It's essentially addressing those who are undecided about whether to support them. And one of the key issues that they discuss are the twin concepts of al-wala wal-bara, or loyalty to the Muslims and disavowal of the unbelievers, and highlighting how it's an indispensable foundation within Islam. And they're discussing how, besides that, comparing current coalition campaigns against the Islamic State to historical battles between the Christians and Muslims, and therefore it's incumbent and necessary upon all Muslims to support IS. A couple of days after that, on August 5th, the Islamic State put out a pamphlet related to happiness in achieving martyrdom, essentially describing what happens where one will be married to 72 virgins and how they'll be wearing jeweled crowns, and that those who are the noblest martyrs among them are those that don't turn their face from death or are afraid of death, and that martyrs actually inflict special harm upon the enemy more than others would otherwise. And it describes how the Islamic State's martyrs die smiling, smelling of perfumes of paradise. However, it clarifies that only God chooses who enters paradise and achieves martyrdom. A couple of days after that, on August 8th, the Islamic State put out one about those who fail to come out for jihad, and how, asking rhetorically how people can stand in the way of all the suffering of Muslims, whether it's Muslim women or the prisoners and the like. It questions these individuals' adherence to Islam and asking what jihad they are practicing in their homes and lying on their couches. And they state that those who believe they are waging jihad just by raising their families and making ends meet and supporting other mujahideen are mistaken. This is not true jihad, according to the Islamic State. And they conclude by taunting these individuals and comparing them to women, and urges other Muslims not to follow their example. And the last pamphlet that they put out during this time period was on August 13th about zakat, and was criticizing those who hinder or prevent the giving of zakat, and it stipulates certain conditions for management of the zakat, highlighting that it must be paid into the central treasury of the caliphate, and then concludes by discussing the benefits of zakat, showing that it purifies money and the soul, and that it's an important pillar within Islam, and that it absolves sins.
And what have we seen during this time period related to the Islamic State's governance activities?
During these 2 weeks, the Islamic State put out two videos related to it that were interesting. The first one was on August 2nd, related to its marriage contracts office, and explains how it was set up and that the steps that people must go through before they can be married, essentially, where they must have medical tests to ensure that the next generation will be free of disease. And then they interview a number of prospective husbands to speak about how easy and painless these blood tests were. Then it highlights how the marriages are conducted, essentially, with the bride and the groom, the bride's father, and witnesses. And then they conclude the video with a defense of polygamy as practiced by the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Then about a week later, on August 8th, the Islamic State talked about its efforts related to refugees and displaced persons, and highlighting how they were ones who are now receiving individuals into their territory, essentially showing that this was highlighting, you know, that there was some level of stability and normalcy within their territory, and that these individuals were fleeing the regime areas in Syria, and that they're encouraging those who lived in the regime area to further come to the Islamic State, and that they would help anybody and welcome anybody who's willing to come. And then they conclude by interviewing those who have come and explaining how the Islamic State has, in fact, helped them since they came to the territory. And in particular, this video is highlighting the region of Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria.
And of course, we have new anti-Islamic State releases that have come out. What have you seen during this two-week period in that regard?
So as usual, Sheikh Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi put out yet another pamphlet or essay related to the issue of extremism in the use of takfir. This one came out on July 28th, and explaining how this topic is extremely serious and that it has wide-ranging implications and consequences, and that there are common errors which people fall into when using takfir, whether through ignorance or malice. For example, declaring someone as an unbeliever without giving them a chance to learn about Islam, or declaring someone an unbeliever merely for praising unbelievers without properly considering the case. Other errors, he says, includes using takfir against the wives and children of unbelievers without taking their vulnerability into account, or using it indiscriminately against all employees of infidel governments. And then he describes the characteristics of the Kharijites, or the Islamic State, as he calls them. And that one of the biggest issues is that they use it against innocent Muslims, and saying that they made narrow what God made more expansive. Then a couple of days later, on August 2nd, Majlis Shura Ahl Ilm Fi Sham, a group of scholars, some related to jihadi organizations in Syria, some that are independent Salafi scholars, some who are more Ikhwani type of scholars. Some of these scholars also do not live in Syria, but are supporting this sort of grouping of individuals to try and centralize sort of religious rulings. And it talks about the cooperation and conditions and coordination with the Turks in repelling the Islamic State and the PKK inside of Syria. Since there have been a lot of questions for many within the jihadi camp on the legitimacy of actually working with Turkey. And that in this statement by this grouping of scholars, they highlight that everyone's deserted the people of Syria, and that they've been left alone essentially to fight the Islamic State, the Assad regime, the Shia and the atheistic Kurds, except for Turkey, both its people and its government, highlighting how Turkey's taken in refugees, opened its clinics to the wounded, and has fed and clothed the vulnerable. And then they go on to say that the Turkish government is among the best of Islamic governments and praises the ruling party, the AKP, for being Islamic. Therefore, it's legitimate for the Mujahideen, according to them, to cooperate and coordinate with the Turkish government. The PKK and the Islamic State are enemies, and therefore it's okay to target both of them. The last one comes out on August 9th, and this is by Sheikh Abdullah al-Muhaisani, an independent jihadi ideologue who's based in northern Syria but is close to both Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham. Again, he talks about the issue of takfir, especially in the extremism of it, and excommunicating people based on suspicion or whims, and highlighting that it's constitute a very serious sin and will condemn those who commit it to hellfire. Then he goes on to highlight various types of extremism within takfir, essentially saying that declaring takfir on the basis of possible action, i.e. preemptively declaring takfir on a group of people because of action some of its members, and then declaring takfir without proper proof. These are all major issues that people need to be aware about and not fall into.
And we also have one release during this time period related to Jabhat al-Nusra's governance activities. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so on August 9th, Jabhat al-Nusra put out a video message of a graduation ceremony for one of its new Sharia classes, and bringing people to one of their Sharia institutes and explaining the importance of study and scholarship within jihad, and explaining that they established this institute, as well as many others, to educate young people in the proper forms of Islam and to remove ignorance from them. And that they're also emphasizing avoiding extremism and radicalism in religious beliefs, most likely a reference to the Islamic State. And then they go on to highlight the different topics they learn, such as Quranic recitation, jurisprudence. And then they conclude by showing a graduation ceremony of these individuals.
And finally, we have a couple miscellaneous releases during this time period that don't really fit into the other categories. Can you tell us about those two?
Yeah, definitely. So the first one was on August 2nd with AQAP's Ibrahim al-Rubaysh, who has since been killed. This was a posthumous release. And he was talking about the role of women in jihad. And he highlights the rewards promised to male mujahideen in paradise, and then asks how women can hope to attain these same types of rewards. He goes on to talk about the wives of the mujahideen and how they'll enter paradise with them, even if they just remained in their homes. And he reminds the listener that those who are unable to fight jihad for good reasons can be judged on other things, explaining that at the last day, female believers will be judged on many good deeds, such as raising children to fight in jihad or praying for the mujahideen, and that mujahideen need good wives who will be patient and suffer with them and will share their beliefs, and that this world is transient and fleeting. And then the second one was from August 8th by Sheikh Hussein bin Mahmoud, who put out a written essay related to the bombing of the Asir emergency building of the Saudi military by the Islamic State in early August. What's interesting about this is that Sheikh Hussein bin Mahmoud has been one of the biggest cheerleaders or pro-ISIS type of ideologues that we've seen, that has had some legitimacy within the broader jihadi community, and that he isn't just some random guy who came about after the formation or the declaration of the Islamic State, but has been an important ideologue within the milieu for years. So it brings even more weight than the fact that he's criticizing them for this bombing, in part because he argues that it was an overreach and that it would offend public opinion and that the Saudi state would be able to use it against them. And then he advises towards the end to the Islamic State to choose their targets with greater care so that they do not provide opportunities for the media to manipulate what happened. And he goes on to explain earlier in the pamphlet about how the Saudi state's already been using the media to manipulate sort of the narrative surrounding what happened.
All right. And now here's Aaron's conversation with Samar Batraoui.
Thanks for coming on to the show today, Samar. Happy to have you on the Jihadology podcast.
Happy to be here.
So today we're going to be talking a little bit about Palestinians that have been involved in the Salafi jihadi movement, not nationalist jihadi movements, which we should obviously differentiate from. One of the first things that I think would be interesting to talk about is especially specific to the Palestinians, is that it's got such a strong nationalist identity, obviously, because of the conflict with Israel. Whereas when you look at global jihadi groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and all these other smaller factions, their ideology is about, you know, the caliphate, the broader Islamic empire, not necessarily specific to one particular territory. So could you maybe talk a little bit about the tensions between these two things and why you think Palestinians might
want to get involved in this particular ideology, even though it sort of goes against a lot of, you know, the upbringings, I guess, in society related to the conflict.
Sure. Yeah. In terms of the motivational elements behind that, I think the development of sympathies has a really long background. So Palestinian nationalism is traditionally secular to an extent, even though most Palestinians are Muslims, which is a fact, which is quite relevant. Whereas transnational jihadis are not concerned with national borders as such, but they don't exist in separate spheres. They live in the same world. So inevitably, they're aware of each other's struggles. They often involve themselves in similar issues. They react to each other, learn from each other, and they have shared ideas. Anti-Americanism is one of them, but Palestinian grievances are definitely among these ideas, because I think there's an important distinction to be made between Palestinian nationalism on the one hand and the Palestinian grievances it talks about. Those two are linked, but they're not necessarily linked. Transnational jihadis can also address Palestinian grievances by simply reframing them as Muslim grievances. And this is something that you see within that movement, whether it's with Al-Qaeda in its glory days or with ISIS or Islamic State now. So there are mutual sympathies. I mean, polls showed that in the height of Osama bin Laden's time post 9/11, that Palestinians actually had a lot of support for him. In 2003, there was a poll that showed that 72% of Palestinians expressed some or a lot of confidence in Osama bin Laden. So there are mutual sympathies there, but it's never quite clear where the line is between Palestinian nationalists and transnational jihadis. And I think one of the problems with that is that Palestinian nationalism is relatively young. And until 1967, Palestinians were largely represented by different Arab regimes rather than themselves. So leaders such as Nasser framed it as a pan-Arab cause. It was sometimes framed as a religious cause. But it was very rarely purely about self-determination for Palestinians. So Palestinian grievances have always been framed in terms of different interests of external actors. So it wasn't until the Palestinian Intifada in 1987 that Palestinians themselves really came to represent Palestine. This was, of course, also a time, as you know, that Islam began to play a more prominent role globally, but also in the Palestinian fight against Israel. So it's a very complex historical relationship. There hasn't been a lot of scholarship on it, even though there are a few excellent papers that I will recommend at the end of this podcast. But I think two important things to remember, which make the relationship complex, is that a large part of Palestinians, the large majority, is Muslim. Therefore, Palestinian nationalists can be Muslim without being transnational jihadis. But also, there's a religious significance in terms of the land and symbolism with regards to Jerusalem, which means that in rhetoric, often these things will be framed religiously by Palestinian nationalists, when one can really wonder what the, you know, Islamist element to it is. But those two things also make it easier for transnational jihadists to frame Palestinian grievances as Muslim grievances. So that's an important point to make there. So the Islamism of the early 20th century, so the Muslim Brotherhood mainly, reached Palestine. Al-Banna's son-in-law, Saeed Ramadan, founded a branch of the group in the mid-40s, in 1945. And that really marked the beginning of the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine. And that's important because even though it's not a Salafi jihadist group, it is an Islamist group in Palestine. So it really symbolized the entrenchment and the importance of Islam in the Palestinian struggle. Eventually, part of this group, would split into Hizb ut-Tahrir in 1953. Apolitical Salafism would rise at the same time. But if we're mainly talking about Salafi jihadist organizations, two important ones are Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, which isn't Salafi jihadi, but it will come to play a really important role, as we see today, in the struggle against Salafi jihadis in Palestine. So, just to take a step back to try and answer your question, it is difficult partially because historically speaking, the rise of Islamism occurred after 1967, as did the rise of a really independent notion of Palestinian nationalism. As my opening remark suggested, these do not live in separate worlds. Therefore, they developed alongside each other. There was communication between the two, even though there were no clear organizational links between the two. So I think it's really difficult to delineate where Palestinian nationalism meets transnational jihadism, apart from the fact that they share really important grievances. Now, Palestine is on the Salafi jihadiya agenda, as we know. It was in the Al-Qaeda times, and it is in the IS times. But I think a question we also have to ask ourselves realistically, is it because there is a genuine care for Palestinian grievances? Or is it because Palestine simply is an important issue in the Muslim world, and especially low-level recruits, potential recruits for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, will care deeply about Palestine? So it may also be not entirely instrumental, but definitely partially instrumental from the Salafi jihadi side of the debate to include Palestinian grievances.
Yeah, definitely. But one of the interesting things, though, is that the movement itself has never really been that popular within the different areas where Palestinians have lived, whether it's in Gaza, the West Bank, or even some of the refugee camps. So I was wondering if you could provide a little bit of background on the development of sort of the Salafi jihadi movement among Palestinians in these different spheres and arenas in different parts of the Levant.
Right. Well, in the refugee camps, it's been a bit of a complicated issue. It really has taken over in some Lebanese refugee camps, as you know. It's sort of replaced traditional Palestinian nationalism. There's a really good book on this by Bernard Rougier, who speaks of Ain al-Hilwa refugee camp and really notes the rise of Salafism. And there's actually a theory about this. When I say theory, it's more of a popular science sort of theory. Some journalists and authors from the Middle East have argued that statelessness and exile actually leads many Palestinian Islamists in the diaspora to focus on issues beyond national liberation because of the fact that they are stateless and they have such a poor outlook on being part of this Palestinian national entity. They focus on something bigger, something transnational. And this is actually quite interesting. I know this is not what you asked. I'll get back to your actual question. But I just want to note that this is interesting when it comes to the big ideologues in Salafi jihadism. You know, if you look at Maqdisi, Abu Qatada, and Abdullah Azzam, Azzam is really the only one of those three that has spent a significant portion of his life in Palestine, 25 years, whereas Abu Qatada and Maqdisi aren't. I mean, they're Jordanian Palestinians, so they're essentially diaspora. And the former, Abdullah Azzam, had more of a focus on Palestine in his rhetoric, whereas Qatada and al-Maqdisi really focused more on, say, doctrinal purity and Islam as a social project, with Palestine sort of on a second place. So this is something that may be salient as to explaining, you know, why these ideologues are the way that they are and why they focus on transnational issues even though they are Palestinian. So I think this is really relevant when it comes to the refugee community. Salafism in the West Bank and Gaza has, you know, a recent history. It's really linked to the 30s and 40s, people coming back from Saudi Arabia from their studies and really trying to implement this idea of Wahhabism initially in Palestinian society. In the West Bank, it has had less of a chance to develop simply because Fatah, especially after the Second Intifada, has been quite authoritarian in the way it clamps down on these groups. In Gaza, as we've seen in the past months, it has had more of a chance of developing. And we do have some, you know, worrying Salafi jihadi formations in Gaza, albeit fragmented ones. Apolitical Salafism has been present both in the West Bank and in Gaza. In the West Bank, I think we have less of a crisis when it comes to Salafi jihadism at this moment. And that's because the two territories have experienced such fundamentally different trajectories in the past years since 2007, when Hamas took over in Gaza. They've really become difficult to compare on any issue, whether it's about economics or social welfare or healthcare. It's just, you're talking about two different societies. So I think it's very important to draw a line between Gaza and the West Bank when we're talking about Salafism or Salafi jihadism. I think Salafism has really thrived on and promoted to an extent social religious conservatism in Gaza. And this is something that is much more difficult to achieve in the West Bank, partially because of the fact that Fatah is there. It's internationally backed and it has a policy of very strict control of political and military arenas, but also of social spaces and really any space of intellectual or religious expression like universities. So this makes it extremely difficult for Salafists to organize and mobilize, even for the non-jihadi ones. The West Bank security sector is essentially a counterinsurgency unit with a special focus on preventing religious extremism. And this is not just because the security sector is internationally backed and funded, and there's an international push for this, but also because Fatah realizes that it is facing decreasing popular legitimacy, and this is its way to maintain power. So this construction doesn't really help Fatah's decreasing legitimacy, though, because in especially the post-Second Intifada security coordination with Israel, there has really been a lot of mistrust and frustration among Palestinians about the oppression of any form of, they call it dissent, but essentially opposition. But this authoritarian-style suppression of any form of protest has really suppressed Salafi jihadism, which in a way is a good thing, because the West Bank simply isn't dealing with the same kind of problems and you know, attacks that Gaza has been dealing with in the past months. But I like to think of the status quo in the West Bank as a sort of pressure cooker. It's working for now, but you can't deny the fact that there's a lot of dissatisfaction boiling under the surface. And this only fuels Salafi jihadi ideas, in my opinion. I think you put out a podcast in June that mentioned some primary source material about Hamas and jihadism in Gaza. And you talked about, you know, releases about the demolition of a mosque in Nusayrat refugee camp, attacks on Hamas headquarters, statements warning local people about Hamas attacks, talks about arrest, torture, kidnapping, Hamas's failure of governance. These are all really the most important debates going on when it comes to Gaza and Salafi jihadis in Gaza, or really any form of opposition in Gaza. I mean, Hamas has really suffered from the apparent regional marginalization of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it faces a lot of disillusioned members that are leaving Hamas for other Salafi jihadi organizations, or so the Salafi jihadis claim. And especially with the growing current of global Salafi jihadism, Hamas is really facing a crucial standoff with Salafi jihadis. Not a military one necessarily, but definitely an ideological one. And Salafi jihadis are very aware of Hamas's position because it finds itself caught in between Israel, its competition with Fatah, recent isolation from Egypt, Iranian-Saudi tensions that affect Gaza, all these different things. But unlike the West Bank, where Fatah has chosen the authoritarian style crackdown we've talked about before, Hamas has actually allowed for a certain degree of semi-clandestine mobilization against Israel by a number of groups, several of which are Salafi jihadi, and they're largely responsible for a lot of the rocket attacks we hear about. And Hamas's rationale behind this is that it shields it from multiple forms of criticism. So on the one hand, externally, Hamas can divert blame for these rocket attacks to smaller groups that aren't officially under its command. So it can face the international community and say, well, what can we do? We didn't officially order these attacks, therefore they are not our fault. And then on the other hand, internally, Hamas can diffuse domestic criticism by saying, look, but we do allow resistance against Israel. We're letting these organizations continue the struggle. And this really is rooted in the fact that Hamas, its former legitimacy, comes from being a group that rose up against the then corrupt Fatah. And it claimed that it would do what Fatah failed to do, which is maintaining a revolutionary stance and not becoming a politicized elitist party. It wanted to represent the Palestinian people and to fight against occupation. But now, years later, this is exactly what Hamas has done. It has become a political elite. Its legitimacy is suffering as a result, and this has really opened up the playing field for alternatives, which include, unfortunately, Salafi jihadis in Gaza. So I think one of the core things that I really do want to say is that it's crucial to understand that the challenge of Salafi jihadis doesn't necessarily come from their military capabilities against Hamas, but it comes from the way that they undermine Hamas on an ideological and political level. And this, of course, in turn creates a substantial pressure for change and opposition and potentially more militancy. But it's really essential to understand that they're not necessarily dangerous because they have immense military capabilities. They're dangerous because they have a real potential to undermine Hamas, which at this point really is the better alternative in Gaza.
So in light of all of this, with the rise of the Islamic State in the last year and a half, 2 years or so, how has this sort of changed the scene related to this, sort of smaller movement of jihadis inside of Gaza? Historically, there are always these smaller groups that were infighting with one another, and they'd pop up here, they'd have a different name and reassemble there. In the mid to late 2000s. And you still see some similar dynamics to that, but how has the Islamic State sort of altered any of this? And do you think because the Islamic State has this, caliphate project, which is actually happening in some respects in Syria and Iraq, compared to Al-Qaeda, where they're never able to really get to the stage of controlling territory for more than a few months here or there, how has this really affected what's going on related to these movements inside of Gaza?
I think it's a bit too early to give a substantial answer to that, especially in terms of the organizational connections between them. But we can safely say that the past years and months, we've witnessed a significant boost in the confidence and appeal of the transnational Salafi jihadi movement because of what IS has managed to achieve against all odds. And this will, of course, have affected the Gaza Strip as well. And this bolstered appeal builds upon the already complex historical relationship between Salafism and Palestinian grievances that we've talked about. But there's also a considerable link between Palestine and Syria. There's a considerable presence of Palestinian refugees and factions in Syria, and it has been there even before the onset of the Syrian crisis. And this connection is also present within IS. I mean, there are an estimated 120 foreign fighters there who traveled from Israel and the Palestinian territories. Most of those from Israel are Arab Israelis. And these form a really salient connection between their old and new homelands. They make the community that they left behind more aware of what IS does and what it can do for the benefit of Palestinians. But it also perhaps enhances empathy for Palestinian grievances among IS affiliates. IS released a video in June, which I think is on jihadology, in which Palestinian fighters with ISIS addressed Palestinians and urged them to wage jihad, but also to be patient because they promised that the Islamic State and Sharia law would be coming to Gaza soon. It addressed these Palestinian grievances as an issue in which all enemies of Islam are essentially compliant. And it specifically criticized the government of Hamas as well, which is very interesting. I think that where IS has really succeeded in the Palestinian context in bolstering these Salafi jihadi factions, perhaps even unifying them, is simply because in Gaza specifically, the internal context within which Salafi jihadism has developed is one that suffers a lot from international policies. I mean, the people in Gaza are isolated. Their suffering can only benefit Salafi jihadi rhetoric. And the failure of Hamas to fulfill any of its promises or to govern even mildly efficiently has bolstered the Salafi jihadi appeal as well. And I think Salafi jihadis have really profited from this. It has really given them the opportunity to criticize. They accuse anyone who stands in their way of supporting Israel, which is very convenient. And even though there is not yet a formal affiliation with IS, I think it is unsurprising that Salafi jihadists in Gaza are trying to link themselves to IS. Because like I said before, thus far, IS really has persisted against all odds. And Palestinians in Gaza really need a win, in my opinion. So as long as IS offers the powerful, hopeful alternative that it is offering, then the ideological influence of IS will linger. I mean, there's sufficient ground there in terms of the ideological sympathies. But IS has really managed, with its territorial conquests and with its promise of a caliphate, to deliver. Whereas Al-Qaeda, I mean, obviously delivered and was for a long time a powerful organization in some ways. It never really provided the actual wins that IS is showing. And Palestinians really need a hopeful cause to believe in. I think this is really appealing to a lot of people in Gaza at the moment.
Related to Gaza is obviously also the Sinai. And historically, there have been links between the different elements involved in these movements going across the border between Gaza and Sinai. Of course, we know that the Egyptians have created these different zones where people can't go near the borders anymore, as well as flooding the tunnels with sewage and other acts that I'm sure we don't even know about publicly.
The buffer zone as well?
Yeah, exactly. How is this, you think, affecting what's going on related to the development of these individuals and movements inside of Gaza? And how much do you think there are still links between what's happening in the Sinai and what's going on in Gaza? Or do you think it's more separate now than it has been over the previous 10 years or so?
I think it's been made more difficult by Egyptian government policies. But obviously, there's a proximity in terms of the territory to Gaza. And I think the important point is that they share a target, an immediate target being Israel. I mean, the Sinai group was responsible for some attacks on Israel, I think, earlier this month, or was it last month? So there's a shared target. So there's a potentiality for cooperation there. So even though Egypt has tried to make it more difficult, unfortunately, these measures, such as a buffer zone, aren't the only thing that will separate these groups, especially not in these days. There are still ways for them to make connections. I, unfortunately, don't have any more insight than you do into what the exact connections are. But it's safe to say that with their broad ideology being similar, and with their immediate target being quite similar as well, Israel, it would be highly likely that there will be some sort of cooperation, if possible.
Do you expect that it's possible the Islamic State could announce another wilaya for Gaza, even though they obviously wouldn't necessarily control territory? But we've seen that they've done this in other areas as well, where they've announced it even in places that they don't really control territory, so that they can then justify potentially doing certain actions in Gaza against people such as their enemies in, you know, Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad, because we've already seen attacks by these elements against those groups.
Yeah, I think, you know, if they would, it would be largely symbolically. There would obviously not really be a territorial presence. I really have to note that this is a very difficult issue to talk about, simply because even the most basic statistics are very hard to come by. So I actually don't know how many Salafi jihadis there are in Gaza, even though I researched this issue, even though I recently wrote a paper about it. I mean, estimates vary from Hamas saying, oh, it's just, you know, perhaps 20 deranged lunatics, to Salafis themselves saying we are thousands. So first of all, it's really difficult to say if IS would do that, you know, how many people would that encompass? We don't really know. If it would do that, I think it would be largely symbolic, but actually I don't think it will. My intuition, and this is quite dangerous to say something like this, but my intuition tells me that it would actually involve more risks for them. I think keeping Palestine as a proximate cause is safer, because you don't risk losing anything. Because if rhetorically you keep referring to Palestine or you refer to Gaza and you clearly have ideological support for it and from it, then you're still on the safe side. Whereas if IS would declare, you know, the territory in Gaza to be one of its provinces, then it sort of makes it responsible for developments there. I think there are more risks involved in doing that, because if then an IS province is, for example, under attack by Israel, or if Hamas is clamping down on it, it implies that IS will have failed, whereas now IS is just standing by and sort of offering rhetorical support. So for that reason, I think perhaps they would be hesitant. But of course, it could be an important symbolic win as well. I think perhaps, you know, if Jerusalem were in Gaza, they probably would. But, you know, there's not, Gaza doesn't really have an important holy place as such. So I think the costs really outweigh the benefits of doing that.
Yeah, it could definitely expose them if they're not able to follow through then, in the same way that we've seen in Syria and Iraq and even on smaller levels in Libya. So where do you think this is all going? Obviously, there clearly is a little bit more support for these types of ideas and movements now compared to, say, maybe 5-10 years ago, but it's still more at the fringes in some ways of society. Do you think that this could become a lot more popular in the same way we saw sort of the rise of Hamas in the late 80s and early 90s, or is the idea just too out there in some ways? Where do you think that this will go? I know that speculation is difficult, but I was just wondering, based off of the trajectories and your own knowledge of the area, how you see this playing out in the near term, maybe?
Well, my finest speculation is the following, is that Salafi jihadism will definitely not become what Hamas has become, which is, you know, one of the most important political players in Palestine. I don't think it's heading that way. I think something that's really, really key to bear in mind is that the first Salafi jihadi attack in Palestine was in Gaza in 2001. And for about 10 years, maybe until 2009, 2010, Salafi jihadi attacks were aimed at manifestations of Westernism in Gaza. So, you know, there were hairdressers getting attacked, internet cafes, these kind of symbolic targets. In recent years, the targets have not been Western manifestations. The target has been the political establishment and Hamas. And I think this is the most important thing that Salafi jihadism will do in Gaza, even though the numbers are small, even though the groups are a bit confusing and it seems to be more of a broad movement than a specific group. But I think Salafi jihadism, as I said before, is most dangerous in its potential to challenge Hamas ideologically and politically. And you can see that in its targeting of Hamas, the car bombs that went off last week or 2 weeks ago. And this is where Salafi jihadism is going to be very dangerous, because it puts Hamas in a very difficult position as well. As I explained before, their method of dealing with this issue is perhaps no longer doable. You see that Salafi jihadis are really gaining too much power in Gaza. But then what are Hamas's other options? Security cooperation with Israel is also not an option, because then Hamas would completely undermine itself, both as a representative of Islam and as a representative of Palestinians. So Salafi jihadis are powerful in the sense that they are putting Hamas in an almost impossible position in Gaza. And I think this is what will play out in the coming months and years. It is that depending on how they manage to challenge Hamas's authority, how Hamas manages that, how Fatah manages that, how Israel manages that, Salafi jihadis will achieve some kind of political change. But I don't believe that they're going to become a really important and big political actor in Palestine.
Great. Well, thanks for coming onto the show, Samar.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from August 9th through the 16th.
During that time period, AQAP announced that they conducted 32 military operations, which is a huge increase in the amount of
operations that they usually conduct in about a week's length. Also during that time period, 9 foreign fighters officially were announced killed in Syria with a number of different jihadi organizations. While in Iraq during that time period, 8 foreign fighters were killed with the Islamic State.
On August the 10th, Ansar al-Sharia in Libya's electricity office provided alternative sources for electricity generation in areas they control in Benghazi.
Also on the 10th, Wilayat al-Khair of the Islamic State shows off its hose production work in northern area of the province.
On August the 11th, Jabhat al-Nusra in northern rural Hama releases an infantry enrollment poster locally. The preferred age is 16 to 23, and individuals interested must bring a voucher.
On the 11th as well, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State shows off its grape harvest.
Also on the 11th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State showed off a poultry farm.
On August 12th, Harakat Ahrar al-Sham al-Islamiyya announces its full support for Turkey's safe zone and calls for broader cooperation in North Aleppo.
On August the 13th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State creates a new media point in Tal Abta, Iraq.
Also on the 13th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State shows off its car dealership in Mosul.
Still on the 13th, Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State builds a sports hall in Al-Qaraya district.
On August 14th, the Islamic State releases its official monthly calendar for the month of Dhul al-Qida.
And finally on the 15th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State settles disputes and reconciles differences between the al-Bakir and al-Marud clans of the al-Aqida tribe. If you have any feedback, you can email podcast@jihadology.net, and you can find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please consider taking a moment to rate and review it in iTunes, which will help more people find the program.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Samar for coming onto the show and sharing her expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly, and to Elizabeth Carruthers for helping with background research on the primary source material. Until next time, I'm out.